The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Hadley Baker, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 17th, 2020. Lawfare founder Bobby Chesney and Lawfare contributing editor Steve Vladek host the weekly National Security Law Podcast from the University of Texas Law School, where they discuss current developments in national security law. This week's episode had lots of content that we thought Lawfare Podcast listeners might be interested in hearing, so we are bringing it to you in a distilled form. In this episode, the fourth edition of a Lawfare-edited national security law podcast, Bobby and Steve discuss the legality of President Trump's claims that he might adjourn Congress, whether or not he has total authority, as he claims, over when the economy should reopen, and the latest in the 9/11 case at Guantanamo. Please note that they recorded this podcast on Wednesday, April 15th. It's the Lawfare Podcast bonus edition. The National Security Law guys talk adjourning Congress, total authority, and Guantanamo.
Hello from Austin and welcome to episode 163 of the National Security Law Podcast. We're brought to you by the Robert Strauss Center, University of Texas. Wednesday night, April 15th, 2020. I'm Bobby Chesney.
I'm Steve Vladek. I guess it would have been tax day.
Yeah, I had a panic moment earlier where I couldn't remember if I imagined or it was real that they extended by 90 days the filing deadline. And I looked at my watch and saw it was the 15th and I completely freaked. I was calling my wife like, we got to go get our taxes done.
So apparently Marty Lederman is calling me. Hi, Marty. Oh,
visual evidence. Seriously? It would be really funny if you could get enough sound quality there to pick it up and be like, hey, we're recording live, Marty. What you got going on?
I suspect Marty's calling me to talk about our first topic on tonight's episode. But so here I was this afternoon thinking like we're going to have a nice, fun chat about federalism and in-ray debs and the president's power or lack thereof to override local and state shelter-in-place orders. And all of a sudden, Twitter starts blowing up about the president's power to adjourn Congress. And I have to say, like, I mean, Charles the First. And as you know, I revel in obscure, irrelevant constitutional provisions that have never been used. And so the adjournment clause, I was like, why is this a thing? And then I was like, oh, shoot. There's a press conference going on right now.
We did Noel Canning the other day.
Good timing.
Yes, and so it was somewhat fresh in my mind, but I confess that I neglected to tell my students a few weeks ago or a few classes back that one possible factor we might see would be an attempt to expand beyond the adjournment clause. So we'll unpack the power and its limits. Because there is a power.
There's power.
The president to adjourn Congress. And actually, I can't remember if I even got around to saying it in class, but I had a thought at the time as I was prepping that class that it might be kind of fun to talk about what is shocking to many people to learn that there is a power, but then you learn how it works and you realize, oh, there's a reason nobody knows about this.
And there's a reason why it's never, ever, ever been done in the 231-year history of this country.
A lot of that going around.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like Trump is just trying to top himself, and like he's progressively trying to drive all constitutional law professors crazy, and he's succeeding.
Oh, absolutely. Or give us full employment. The man is grist for the mill of CNN, New York Times, all these other entities he doesn't like. So why not come on, professors too?
So speaking of con law, we also do want to talk a fair amount about what we had planned to spend much of our time on today, which is this new PR push that the president's going to somehow assert the authority to override or countermand these local and state shelter in place orders. Bobby and I think, as will disappoint some of you, I think are in complete agreement about the relevant legal questions and answers in this space.
It takes debatable issues to get us to divide. And this one, that's not quite fair. We will endeavor to find where's the kernel of support or defense one could spin up in the right circumstances.
Right. Maybe there are individual lines in Justice Brewer's majority opinion in Debs that we find more or less satisfying.
So we will. Well, I think it's really fun to have an excuse to do what we're going to do, which is not a full-fledged deep dive.
Maybe a moderate dive.
It is a moderate dive, to a dive to a moderate depth.
So we're
spend a lot of time in pandemia.
Yep. We're gonna do a very quick detour to Guantanamo, where there was an important ruling in the 9/11 case by the trial judge, by the momentary trial judge in the 9/11 case.
Well, I am curious, what's the count on trial judges we've had so far?
I honestly, Bobby, this will be the fourth trial judge in the, when this judge is replaced and we get a new one, I think it'll be the fourth judge in like 4 or 5 years. So, yay.
Any particular reason to think that's going to change if they can't resolve the case sometime soon? I mean, are we stuck in a perpetual cycle? You know, there's this phrase, being inside the other guy's OODA loop. You know, you hear that in military circles. It's this idea the other side can act and is operating quicker than you can make your decisions and you take your actions.
The cycle is outside the OODA loop.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's start with the president's power to adjourn Congress.
I know. Many listeners are thinking, if only the president had the power to adjourn this podcast. But my friends, he has no such power. Let me see if I can give us the...
Can we start
with the text?
Yes.
I got the text here.
So for those of you who are not actually watching on our screen and are listening at home, what I am sharing is Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution. Bobby, can you see it?
Yep, got it.
And so Article 2, Section 3, he shall from time to time give Congress information on the State of the Union, blah, blah, blah. He may on extraordinary occasions convene both houses or either of them. And in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. That's the clause. So can we talk a bit about how congressional sessions work?
That's a good idea. Let's explain the distinction between, you know, recess and adjournment in particular.
So in the old days, right? So in the old days, Congress was a part-time concern. And so what that meant was that, like, take the first Congress, right? The Congress elected in 1788 that meets for the first time, I think, in what, March of 1789, right? Congress would have multiple sessions, Bobby, but there would be long blocks where Congress was, quote, out of session because Congress went home. And this was the norm all the way up to the Civil War. And so you'd have a Congress that would have maybe three sessions over 2 years. And then you'd have recesses, right? And most of the recesses, not all of them, but most of the recesses in this time period are what we call intersession recesses, where Congress is adjourned for more than 3 days, and indeed for months at a time, which is important in other contexts because it's during such formal recesses that the president clearly has the power to do what are called recess appointments, which is to fill vacancies in government positions, in offices of the United States, with appointments that will last until the expiration of the next session of Congress. So for example, if between the second and third session of, say, the second Congress, you know, President Washington named a new Secretary of Treasury, he wouldn't be acting. He would be a full Secretary of the Treasury only until the end of the third session of Congress. So only until Congress had time to vote up or down on the nomination. This changes slowly but steadily so that now, and for the better part of the last few decades, right, Congress doesn't adjourn like that anymore, right? That is to say, most Congresses, which meet for 2 years, have two sessions, one that goes from January 3rd of year one to noon on January 3rd of year two, and then one that goes from 12:01 on, you know, January 3rd of year two to noon on, you know, January 3rd of year three, right? So the whole idea is that the two sessions occupy all of the space. Now, the Supreme Court in the Noel Cannon case in 2012 said even recesses within sessions, so-called intra-session recesses, can be recesses for purpose of the recess appointments clause, Bobby, if they're at least 10 days. Right? And so the pro forma sessions that the Senate had for much of the Obama administration weren't recesses because, in theory, Congress could conduct business, even if only by unanimous consent. Okay. This all matters to me as setup because it is no longer the case that Congress is repeatedly voting on when to adjourn. Under a 1970 statute, and actually, let me pull up the statute. Under a 1970 statute that is codified, if you want to follow along at home, at 2 USC section 198. And let me sort of pull this up on share screen so that we can all look at it. Unless otherwise provided by the Congress, the two houses shall adjourn sine die, which means basically without a, not to a date certain, without a date, not later than July 31st of each year, or, Bobby, right, provide, in the case of odd number of years, not later than July 31st, by such concurrent resolution adopted in each house by roll call vote, for the adjournment of two houses from that Friday in August, which occurs at least 30 days before the first Monday in September of such a year to the second day after Labor Day, right? So there are provisions in the code, there are provisions in the code for adjournments, but Bobby, the norm has become that Congress remains in session right up until Congress is over. Sorry, that was a lot of talking.
No, no, it's great. And so the stakes here, this is entirely about, as the president stated expressly, trying to access as much as possible the ability to make recess appointments, to fill judgeships and to fill offices.
Now, because, you know, he's had so much trouble filling judgeships.
Right. So the first thing to say is, you know, as far as the judgeships go, there's no problem there to be circumvented. As far as the offices go, the problem is he doesn't ever nominate anybody, or sometimes when he does, there are problematic nominations. But this is not a situation where this is an actual problem for him. So what do we understand is going on here? Well, this is symbolism. This is narrative shaping. To some extent, it's bluster. To some extent, maybe it's even just the random hyperbole that he tends to throw out there from time to time. Sometimes, no doubt, greatly surprising everybody who's working for him. And this is a point I want to go to the meta level just briefly, because in that sense, there are some who would say, y'all are going way too deep on something he just randomly said. And he didn't really mean, he's never going to act on. And because I heard that, I got that in my ear a fair amount from folks on our next topic, which I think was actually misplaced as a critique, because I think he meant very much what he said, because he kept repeating it. But I think it doesn't really matter. And I suspect I know the answer, but I wonder if you agree that even when the president makes hyperbolic, blustery, and rather random off-the-cuff assertions of the scope of his legal authority, if it's an important authority to the issue, then it's not just proper to respond with debunking for people like us. It's a duty. It's an obligation. It's part of civic virtue to articulate what is wrong with that, so that people who actually might care about these issues understand where the lines actually are, and that there's real harm if the president sort of tries to, by accident or otherwise, is in the position of kind of adversely possessing power by just asserting it.
I agree with every single word of that. I mean, you know, and I'm the one who's even more prone, I think, to go down rabbit holes than you are.
It's true. It's a measure of how ridiculous some of this is that I've been sucked into doing this.
Seriously.
I often tell you not to get sucked in.
Totally. But it's worth talking about this power in particular, because the founders, this was not a random provision in the Constitution, right? That, you know, adjourning parliament and proroguing parliament
did anyone ever do that?
Well, Charles I. Right. And how'd that work out for him? It only cost him his head. So, you know, the founders, I mean, the reason why this clause is in the Constitution is because the founders wanted to actually make explicit that the president generally did not have the power to adjourn Congress, right? That rather than leaving it unspoken, the purpose of Article 2, Section 3 is actually mostly to deny power to the president, and to delineate the single circumstance in which this power is allowed to be exercised by the president. And Bobby, we should say, because we haven't said it yet, it has never been exercised, right? There is not a single episode. There are instances in American history of the president using the power in Article 2, Section 3, Bobby, to convene Congress, right? So Harry Truman famously calls Congress back into a special session, I think in 47, right, to pass emergency economic legislation. But that's different, right? This is sending Congress home. And I understand the conspiracy theorists who say, well, the Republican Senate will do whatever they need, you know, the president wants them to do. I think there are two different reasons why this is not something Mitch McConnell's gonna want to do. The first is, it would be very easy for the Democrats to shift all of the blame for this to McConnell. And let me walk through how, right? Bobby, the president can only adjourn Congress if the chambers disagree. So imagine if the Senate passes a new resolution to adjourn Congress tomorrow, right? If I'm Nancy Pelosi, I pass the exact same resolution through the House. And then it's Mitch McConnell's fault that Congress went home, right? And so Mitch McConnell adjourned Congress, not President Trump, but still the Republicans. And related to that, in the middle of a huge economic crisis and an unprecedented public health crisis, you're going to send home the people who write the checks, right?
No, I think there's no chance that the members in Congress would be on board with some plan that would serve what purpose for the White House?
Well, this is the other thing, right? So we're not talking about judges, right? Because when it comes to judges,
they're all being approved.
Right. We're talking about executive branch officers. So let's play out the string. Right. So imagine Mitch McConnell actually does roll over and let Trump do this. Right. So you get a bunch of like sub cabinet appointments that are only as good, that are only good until the next president comes into office. I mean, you know, the first, if things go badly for Trump in November, the first thing Biden does on January 20th is he fires all of these recess appointees, right, which he'd have the unquestioned constitutional authority to do. So all of this so that you get like 7 months of deputy secretaries of certain agencies. I mean,
yeah, no, that, which is why this isn't a real thing, but this is my other point. It's not real. He's not going to try to do this. And certainly no one's going to go along with it, even if he tries to float it. So this is just another one of his passing fancies, but it's still important, especially because of the concatenation of all these sorts of bogus claims of Article II authority, that it be shot down and people call out and say it's not okay for the President of the United States, who's sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution, to constantly be making these absolute power claims. This isn't, he's not James the First, and he's certainly not Charles the First. Let me quote Alexander Hamilton from Federalist number 69.
That guy.
Yeah. Fourthly, the president can only adjourn the national legislature in the single case of disagreement about the time of adjournment. This is ridiculous.
Okay. It's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. The question is, why is he doing it? And so, right, I mean, because I always, with Trump, like the question is, if this is just a stupid little distraction, what is he distracting us from? And so I think part of what's going on here is shifting the conversation away from a couple of other things that have happened, including first, and we're not going to talk about this that much, but like, you know, defunding the U.S. involvement in the World Health Organization, right? Second, right, the news about sort of how far behind we are on testing, right? I think the statistic that came out today is we've hit 3.3 million tests nationwide, which if you're scoring at home means 1% of the country has been tested once.
One time. Let me quickly join in on that. So on the first one about the WHO thing, I don't think he wants to change that conversation at all, because I don't think he views that as a dangerous conversation for him. I think it's done. I think that was done both for substantive and for narrative reasons. Narrative being my shorthand for like, hey, here's the story I want to tell about myself, because that is ultimately conducive to his larger and at this point strategically essential narrative that this is China's fault, not his fault. And of course, why does it have to be binary? I do think substantively, I just can't resist saying like,
but Bobby, it's contributory negligence, not comparative negligence.
There you go. Very good. There are serious problems with the WHO and the extent to which they seem to be unwilling to cross China and have people working there who And you know, I'm sure you saw or heard about the one particularly bizarre instance where the one official was acting almost like he couldn't perceive the word or the concept of Taiwan. It was really something. But I completely agree on the second point, that this is about trying to steer away from any narratives or the media focusing on misfeasance and absence of feasance. Is there an omission of feasance? With respect to all the things that could be done by a strong and vigorous chief executive to help coordinate and supply the national effort that, by the way, is in his interest to do, aside from the fact that it should be in the interest of any president to try to help in that way. But his bugaboo seems to be just frustration with the closure orders. The only pathway out of the closures, the only safe pathway out of it, barring significant medical breakthroughs that all seem fairly far off still, is an extremely robust test and trace regime. An extremely robust test regime, we're not remotely close to it yet. And the federal government seems to be, if anything, sort of eschewing responsibility for having a leading role in helping us get there. So yeah, I agree with your second point.
Okay, but so then this brings us to the second most preposterous thing the president, or no, actually maybe the most preposterous thing the president said this week.
Yeah, this is more. This is more.
And this is the one that really, I mean, this is the one that pushed the National Review, like, to go all nuclear against
John Yoo.
Well, yeah,
John Yoo.
I don't like talking about that guy, but yes.
yeah, but it's a sign, right? Although I will say,
when you've even lost John Yoo on executive power from a conservative president, I think that's a sign.
I will say, I had so much fun yesterday appearing in Sarah Krebs' class at Cornell. And at one point we talked about that, and I hadn't yet known what John had said. So I predicted that he would come out against this on the theory that I think John and I are probably similar in age. Guys like us who kind of come up relatively conservative, John very conservative, obviously. There are certain planks in the platform that interest you, federalism being one of them. John's very invested, as everyone knows, famously or infamously, in executive power in the realms of foreign affairs, national defense, and national security, but on more sort of bread and butter policy categories, federalism, one would not predict him to be a nationalist over a federal system advocate. And so anyways, long-winded interruption there to characterize John's intervention.
It's fine. So the president says he has the authority to order states and local governments to reopen, which, by the way, there are like, it's like, Mark Hamill in one of the new Star Wars movies, right? You know, interesting law, interesting sentence, every word in it was wrong, right? Like, you know, so the my authority, he says, is total. But then Pence comes back, and bad enough that Trump says something like, my authority is total. But then Pence, who's supposed to be, you know, the adult in the room, comes back and says, of course, during an emergency, the president's authority is plenary. Right.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, if they had just used different words, right? The president, Bobby, promised a legal brief. We haven't seen it yet. So let's walk through all of this, right? And let's try to do this in a way that makes some sense. So most of us are subject, Bobby, to some combination of local and state shelter in place and or stay home orders. Right? Those are authorities promulgated by our local or state officials under their police powers, under the state constitution of the relevant state, right? Every state delegates police general regulatory powers, including for public health, to some actor within the state government. And just to be clear, it's not like even the governors, Bobby, can order us to reopen, right? Governor Abbott can't say to a restaurant, I order you to reopen. He can just remove the obstacle to them reopening, right? Like that's
the proprietor in a free country, the business person who owns that business can decide like, yeah,
so,
nah,
so, for,
I think,
so first
I,
of all,
I think I'm sitting this out.
Right. So first of all, not even the governors can order anybody to reopen, but sure as hell the president can't. And there are two different reasons why, right? Reason number one is because he didn't close them in the first place, right? This would be a very
famously, right? He didn't want to close them.
Right. This would be a very different conversation if he had sought and received legislation from Congress that, for example, allowed him to order the closure of any non-essential business that affects interstate commerce, right? That actually probably would have been a viable Commerce Clause statute. It would have allowed him to shut down most big businesses if he'd wanted to, which he didn't. That didn't happen. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, the federal government doesn't, so first of all, the federal government maybe has the power, Bobby, over big businesses, right, through the Interstate Commerce Clause. But the federal government—
Just big businesses?
I think it depends on which generation of the Supreme Court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence we're talking about. I don't think local schools can be covered by a federal statute, right, unless it's a funding, unless it's suspended, like not under the Commerce Clause, right? I think small businesses, especially very small businesses, I think you'd have a hard time covering under the Commerce Clause. So
really? Wait, no, we got to go down on that. I'm surprised Wickard v. Filburn doesn't change your mind on that. I mean, these would be commercial activities. Surely the aggregation of principle applies.
In Wickard, it was the market, right? In Wickard, this is why I'm talking about a world after NFIB. Right, where the economic, non-economic activity distinction, where the whole point is that Congress can regulate, you know, local subsistence farmers. Congress can tell Angel Rach, you know, how to grow marijuana in her backyard, right? Because those are commodities. But I think not every feature, Bobby, of a local stay home or shelter in place order touches stuff that can be regulated by Congress through the Commerce Clause. We can disagree about
that. I agree that there's going to be slices and there may be pockets.
Yeah.
But I think that for the main event, for those who are eager to see the economy reopen,
yes,
the main event is the overriding or repealing of any level, state or local authority that is keeping most businesses closed.
Fair enough.
I think is all something Congress... I don't love it that Congress has this much legislative authority, but I think they've got it.
Listen, we've talked about this before on this podcast, right? I think that there are a bunch of powers that the Congress has already delegated to the president that he hasn't used in this crisis. I think there are yet more powers Congress could delegate to the president that he hasn't used in this crisis. The critical point, right, the point where everyone across the ideological spectrum agrees is at most this power belongs to Congress, right. And there's
it's a legislative power.
And there's no statute. Right, there is no statute giving the president any authority to do anything like this. Instead, right, the two things the president could do coercively to really, really try to sort of force the issue, and we've talked about this before, he can order the entire federal workforce back to its offices, right?
Yeah, and doesn't do much.
And well, in some states it does. I mean, in Virginia, that would actually, I think, have a pretty big impact, right? And right, he can mess with funding. He can withhold Stafford Act money. He can withhold CARES Act money. Bobby, maybe not legally. But
I was going to say, you know, my view on this is that that would be unconstitutional coercion. That'd be even worse than the actual overt coercion scenario that was a problem in NFIB 1B versus Sebelius and was flagged as a theoretical problem by Rehnquist in South Dakota.
This
would be a great example of how it could be even worse.
Bobby, he'd lose the lawsuit. But it might take 2 years.
But he might win for a while,
That's the problem.
And, of course, the one power he's definitely got that is legitimately his, and he should exercise it as much as he feels appropriate, is the bully pulpit. The rhetorical presidency is a real power of the presidency. Yep. He can do that. He can use that. But he can't resist. Now, to your point about there's no statute on point, someone may say, but the national emergency. In fact, someone did say it. As you noted, the vice president said it. I must say, this was a disappointing moment. So I'm going to read the quote.
Oh, please.
So here's the original quote.
I'm going to eat my grapes.
Good. Food break for Steve.
Yeah.
Trump said, quote, when somebody is president of the United States, the authority is total, which has a nice parallelism with when you're the president that does it, it's not a crime.
Right. If the president does it, it's not a crime.
Right. So when somebody is president of the United States, the authority is total. And that's the way it's got to be, he went on.
By the way, how'd that work out for Nixon?
He says, it's total, and the governors know that. Pence gets up and says, quote, you can look back through times of war and other national emergencies.
Are you kidding me, coach?
I know. And then goes on to say, oh, I've lost it. Where did it go? I had to.
If you take a long, hard look at Cornell Rooker's record, this is the West Wing bit, right? About how, you know, so Penn says, if you go back and look through history, you'll see that the president's powers during war and national emergencies has always been plenary. Right.
Yeah.
I may have missed a couple words, but is that basically the thrust?
It is. I'm frustrated because my screen froze up when I was trying to give the exact language, because what's clear from the language is, and he also refers to, we're going to get you a briefing on that. We can brief that.
Any day now, OLC.
Shoot, I really wish I could find it.
Well, so can I, go ahead. Sorry.
No. We're belaboring the point too much. So he's invoking the idea, Pence is, that because a national emergency declaration has been issued under the National Emergencies Act, that this somehow confers plenary authority to do what Trump is saying. This was not confusing. He was saying he has authority to order the reopening under the National Emergencies Act. And of course, as you say, there is no reading of the National Emergencies Act itself, or more to the point, any of the statutes that the declaration of a national emergency then triggers, that would warrant the claim that declaring national emergency has ought to do with what Trump is talking about. There's no statutory authority, full stop. The only interesting questions are found under the headings. Well, the headings we're going to get to in a moment, but they're not statutory headings.
Can I say one word about the National Emergencies Act? Because we have talked about it a lot on this show, especially in the context of the border wall, right? And so I think a lot of folks are saying, well, wait a second, didn't he just use that to do something he wasn't supposed to do with the border wall? So here's why even the border wall precedent doesn't do anything to help Trump here. The National Emergencies Act is not a substantive statute. And what I mean by that is there is no independent substantive authority that the president gets, Bobby, under the National Emergencies Act simply by snapping his fingers and declaring a national emergency. Instead, right, the National Emergencies Act is unlocking, right, powers that Congress has already delegated to the president in other statutes where the delegation is limited to times of national emergency and sometimes war, right? War or national emergency.
Right. So the question is, there's a roster of these statutes. And the question is anything on that roster that it's like a lockbox full of interesting tools, powerful tools in some cases. And the declaration unlocks the lockbox. So Trump can reach in there now for the first time, has the ability to use these. In the border wall context, one of the tools in the toolbox is the authority to reprogram certain DOD budget dollars. And he did that famously, and that was what that controversy was about. There's nothing of that kind that pertains to trying to override state public health measures or otherwise doing things in furtherance of interstate commerce.
So to put it another way, I mean, what the vice president should have said is that the president's powers are at their apex, right, when the president declares a national emergency. That is clearly true, because in those circumstances, the president has all of the powers he has in regular times, plus the additional statutory powers that he only has during a time of a national emergency. But there's a whole lot of real estate between the apex of the president's constitutional powers in a separated powers democracy and total power, which I feel like there's a system of government that has the word total in it somewhere.
Totalism. and yeah, so put it in Jackson steel seizure categories terms. This is not a steel seizures category one scenario. And interestingly, it's not a category three scenario, because I don't think there's certainly not a statute that forbids such presidential action, nor is it a situation where Congress, you know, kind of toyed with it and then decided not to do it, a la the Korean War. But as long as we're talking about the steel seizures case in the Korean War, why don't we talk about claims that Article 2 under emergency conditions includes within it some sort of plenary power to do what the country needs to be done?
Why? I've seen that movie.
Well, that was exactly what was argued by the Truman administration in steel seizures. And it's really amazing in some ways how similar this is. In both cases, you have a real deal emergency going on. No one denies there's an emergency with COVID-19, just as no one would deny there was an emergency with the Korean War. In both cases, the thing the president either did do in Truman's case or kept saying he was going to do and is still reserving, I'll get to this in a second, he is still reserving the claim that he has this authority. Let me actually get to that now. When he said in yesterday's press conference that he was going to talk to the governors and the governors will ultimately kind of make a decision, he prefaced it by saying, I have authorized them to go ahead and open up when they're ready.
Bobby, I've authorized you to open up when you're ready.
I'm going to do it right now. By the way, tonight's episode is brought to you by Austin Beer Works Pearl Snap, which is a fine pilsner. I highly recommend it. in both cases, Truman with his decision to try to seize and operate the steel mills, Trump with his assertion that he might order the states to open up, there's a two-step process. There's an assertion of an authority that Congress could give, but has not given. And then there's the execution of that authority once it exists. This calls to mind the opinion of one Hugo Black, opinion for the court in Steel Seizures, much less famous than its brother, the opinion of Justice Jackson, but nonetheless the opinion of the court, where it's a typical Hugo Black formalistic distinction between the legislative function and the executive function. And Black quite correctly pointing out that what we're talking about here was Truman deciding to grant to himself a power that Congress had given other presidents and could have given to him, but had not given to him. He decided to go ahead and give it to himself, saying, well, but it's an emergency, so I need to do it. And the answer of the Supreme Court was, it's an emergency and need are not sufficient conditions to have the power. You have to have it anyways under Article 2, which you don't, or you need to have it given to you by delegation from Congress. Same here, only this time it's much worse because there's a federalism obstacle in addition to the separation of powers obstacle. It's both the horizontal and the vertical dimension. It's especially a federalism problem if it literally were to be a directive to the governors and the mayors and the county commissioners or county judges. If it was a directive to them, telling them to change their policies, that's the most manifestly unconstitutional from a federalism perspective thing. That's the very paradigm of forbidden commandeering. If instead, more plausibly, relatively speaking, he weren't to do that, but rather were to simply issue an executive order purporting to order the private sector to hereby be liberated from your oppressive state and local government public health directives, then the question becomes whether that has any force and effect under the Supremacy Clause. It would be a classic example of how, well, sure, that would be supreme law of the land if it was constitutional to do. And that brings us back to the question, where does the president get the power to do this? Unless you believe he has inherent power to do it in general on emergency grounds, or setting that aside, you might make, and now we come to where there's a kernel of an interesting argument to be had, and we should flesh it out. Can you get there by saying that the circumstances of the shutdown orders obviously do substantially and severely even interfere with interstate commerce? That descriptive.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's true. And everyone who's had con law immediately thinks, wait a minute, I remember there's something about things states might do to interfere with interstate commerce. Oh, yeah.
The Dormant Commerce Clause.
Dormant Commerce Clause, right. This is the idea that the Commerce Clause, more specifically and properly, the interstate commerce or the commerce among the states?
Among.
I think it's among the states. Clause.
Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3.
Is a grant of legislative power to Congress. But in fairness, the Supreme Court has long held that it has a negative, I like to say radioactive or toxic effect that radiates outward just from being in the Constitution and having all this intent behind it to support interstate commerce. It's been construed to have the effect of silently negating some state actions that interfere, that either actually directly discriminate against other states' commerce, which is the easy case, or in the harder cases where what the state is doing is maybe valuable to the state up to a point, but the damaging effect it has on interstate commerce so outweighs this that we say that it's a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. And so the best one can say for Trump, and some have said it, and there's, you know, I Rick Hills at NYU has advanced this view, and you know,
Michael Morley at Florida State.
Yeah, so a few people have said this. I will grant the point, and you know, far be it for me to disagree with smart folks like them. They're really thoughtful on this. I think they're ultimately wrong in how far they go with it. But to the extent that they're saying that, look, there's at least an argument here that there is a role for the executive branch, specifically, I assume this is how they would say it, although I don't know it, specifically a basis to go to court in the proper way, to go to court, to try to get a judge to rule that the state's public health measures at some point might be a Dormant Commerce Clause violation. I think in the abstract, it's true that it's a proper role of the executive branch, even if it's a relatively justified public health measure. You can present the issue, and a court may, as it has in other contexts in the past, may decide that the state's otherwise legitimate state policy or legal action is in fact negated and it's unconstitutional. So you could kind of get somewhere with it. Now, first thing to say about this is Trump wasn't saying he's going to do any of that. He was saying he was going to give an order. So in that sense, Trump wasn't just hinting at or
right. Once again, we're grasping at straws to try to come up with the one possible way you might come up with the legal way to do the thing he's talking about doing.
Right. No, so what I was going to say was before we noted the obvious separation of powers problem with what he was saying from an invasion of congressional prerogatives perspective insofar as he was going to issue an order. But it's also, from this perspective, an invasion of the judicial province and the federal judicial power. The case that people have drawn attention to is an old chestnut, a true old chestnut. In re Debs. Steve, I think we should tell the story of In re Debs and go to moderate depth.
Moderate depth. Set depth for moderate.
Set depth for moderate. He shows a pattern of two-dimensional thinking.
All right. So
can you place that?
Two-dimensional thing. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Very good. Has to be said. Okay, can I set it up? I love the facts here. It's very interesting.
This dovetails with my favorite, set of statutes.
1893, a little bit of a depression going on.
A little bit.
You'll recall the Pullman Company, the Pullman Palace Car Company. This is the big, massive railway car manufacturing company. In the Depression, they cut wages by a quarter, not a quarter as in a coin, but a 25% wage cut, prompts a strike by Eugene V. Debs's American Railroad Union, and they in turn call for sympathy strikes, a boycott from others, other workers in the railway biz, and a lot of railroad employees respond. There are, by different measures at different points in time, more than 20 railroads impacted. More than 100,000 workers on strike. And then in some places, it got violent or riotous. And in one instance, at least, there was a derailed train that was supposed to be carrying U.S. mail. This gets the White House and Congress both engaged, but this brings us to that other Cleveland. Grover is the president of the United States at the time. Particularly concerned about the disruption of the Postal Service. And of course, you have to cast your mind back to the times and remember that in the late 19th century, the U.S. government's postal service was as if today it was the U.S. government that's owning and operating and maintaining the internet and probably also UPS and FedEx too. It was the lifeblood of so much of commerce. And one of the main things the federal government did, the core function in the strike was perceived not incorrectly as a threat to it, and in some instances, a forcible threat to the smooth functioning of it. So DOJ, at Cleveland's direction, goes to court to get an injunction. And the injunction seeks to bar Debs's union from continuing with the strike. And certainly, and there's all kinds of elements to it, including these almost preposterous elements, such as forbidding Debs and the other leaders from even communicating with the employees who are striking, and they get the injunction from a district judge who talks about the Sherman Act and the Interstate Commerce Act as in effect, in net effect, making it illegal to engage in a combination or conspiracy in restraint of trade. Now that sounds like the Sherman Act standard, but in today's perspective, we would never think of that as something you would bring to bear on union activity. That just seems like kind of a taking something that's meant for corporate combinations and turning it inward towards labor law. But of course, this was the 1890s. That development of protection for labor law didn't exist. And the court treated the union's process of organizing itself and for a strike and then administering the strike was treated as a conspiracy to disrupt commerce. So the things go on. Long story short, Debs continues to communicate. There's always telegrams documenting his urging everyone to stay the course with the strike. And so he gets held in contempt of court, he and other leaders, and they get 3 to 6 months sentences for concededly basically violating the injunction. And Clarence Darrow represents him. It goes to the Supreme Court, and they're trying to show, among other things, you know, that there was a misreading of the antitrust laws, that the original injunction was invalid. That's kind of how they need to argue it, or else he's pretty much obviously in contempt otherwise. And the court comes in, with Justice David Brewer writing, with an opinion that is very forcefully in favor of the propriety of what the government had done. So that's where it gets interesting. Does that constitute a precedent that is in some way analogous to present circumstances? Does it show that the executive branch has at least authority to go to the court, even if not to issue a directive straight off the desk of the president, to seek an injunction that would have the effect of shutting down all the state and local laws, or some of the state and local law actions that are shuttering the economy? I think, and I bet you think, this is totally distinguishable. What do you think?
For at least two reasons.
I have my two reasons.
So you go first.
Okay, my two reasons are, we have an In Re Debs action by private actors.
One.
Not public actors. In this case, True. We're talking about the actions of governments. Now, as Rick and I exchanged some Twitter messages earlier, he says, on that point, that makes it more of a dormant commerce clause scenario, because normally you don't see the dormant commerce clause brought to bear against
private parties,
private persons.
Right.
Which brings us to the second distinction. These are independent distinctions. And this is what's really doing the work here. The entire premise of In Re Debs is that there was an illegal activity underway by private actors
in violation of federal law.
That violated federal law. Whereas here we're talking about something at the clear, hard candy core center of the legitimate authority of states.
Listen, I like Rick a lot. I like clever arguments a lot, but you have to read Debs totally out of context, right, to get to Rick's point. Because Rick's point is, can I try to rephrase what you said just in a way that's somewhat please. A little bit more pithy?
that shouldn't be hard.
No. Rick's point, in essence, is that Deb stands for the proposition that the executive branch has the power to walk into court and enjoin violations of the Dormant Commerce Clause. Right? I mean, so therefore, you know, Trump could sue, let's say Governor Cuomo tomorrow, right, announces that, you know, he will not lift his order. Right. Yeah. And so Trump says, I am suing you to enjoin your order insofar as it violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. And Rick says Debs would stand for precedent for that. The problem is that Debs makes no sense, right, without all of the baggage of the federal laws that were being violated. Right. That is to say, Debs is not a Dormant Commerce Clause case. And we know Debs is not a Dormant Commerce Clause case because Debs is not a state. And the Dormant Commerce Clause has never been suggested that it applies to non-state actors. Instead, and this is where it gets into my bailiwick, Bobby, Debs is about local combinations, right, frustrating the enforcement of federal statutes. This Debs is about the Insurrection Act. Debs is about, you know, when can the government use coercive authority to put down local violations of federal law. And indeed, Cleveland...
And Brewer says, like, hey, his whole argument is what you're saying, and therefore the lesser included option of just seeking an injunction.
A bill in equity. That's right. And exactly so. And so, and Cleveland indeed did, I think, at one point, send in the army.
He sent in the U.S. Army. Governors brought in national militias, but also Cleveland sent in the army to Chicago.
But this is the point, Bobby, right? He didn't send in the army to vindicate the Dormant Commerce Clause, right? The army did not go to Chicago to enforce the Dormant Commerce Clause. The army went to Chicago to enforce the underlying federal statutes that the Pullman strike was obstructing the enforcement of. And so, you know, Debs, I think, stands most understandably for the proposition that the executive branch needs no special warrant, needs no statute, needs no special authority to repair to court, right? Short of sending in the military as a mechanism for enforcing federal statutes against recalcitrant local obstruction.
So without taking issue with any of that, although I would like to see what Cleveland actually said. I assume there's a declaration, and we should try to find.
There is. It's in the. I can probably find it. It's in the Army Center for Military History's, you know, comprehensive volume on uses of military force for domestic disturbances.
I'd be curious to see whether he actually framed it in statutory terms, because I can well imagine, because that's also a public and rhetorical document, that it had broad references just to interstate commerce. But either way, doesn't really matter. I think it's perfectly fine and safe to concede the point that the executive branch can, and indeed often has, gone to court to challenge official state actions on the ground that they interfere too much with the Dormant Commerce Clause. In fact, I think that's the very paradigm of a Pike case under the Dormant Commerce Clause. Nothing wrong with that. The problem is that's not remotely what Trump or Pence were saying. Pence was claiming plenary, generic authority to do what needs to be done during emergencies. And the president was claiming authority to direct the activities of governors, et cetera. And anyways, even if Trump came out tomorrow and said, oh, I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. Sometimes I get carried away. What I meant was I will direct the Justice Department to litigate a Dormant Commerce Clause claim. So first of all, that means the courts are the boss of this. Right. Secondly, they would so clearly lose under the current factual circumstances. There's a reason
for two reasons
making that claim.
For two reasons, right? First, the principal critic of the Dormant Commerce Clause on the Supreme Court is Justice Thomas, right? I mean, the Dormant Commerce Clause is not exactly popular.
He says it's a judicial invention. It's in Article One. It's in Article One, Section 8, not the subsequent section that talks about restraints on states. But even if everyone on the court was perfectly fine with applying the Pike analysis and running a relatively ordinary Dormant Commerce Clause analysis, this fact pattern seems to be at, I suppose one could say you never know what the courts might want to do, but the typical case in which the court is willing to strike down a state action under Dormant Commerce Clause grounds is not the state using its public health powers in the thick of a pandemic where the public health authorities largely are saying that right now this is a necessary condition to save lives. I think I'm perfectly comfortable saying it is inconceivable that as long as it's like this, there's not the slightest chance the court is going to say like, yeah, we're kind of going with the executive branch on this one. It's just too much. It's certainly true that over time that hopefully will change. And you can even imagine a situation in which there's a medical breakthrough, and there actually is suddenly a dramatically reduced need. And yet somewhere some county commission or mayor is holding in place, or a state governor is holding in place with the draconian economic shutdown when they truly don't need to be, or at least it's very arguable they don't need to be. Yeah, you can imagine a Dormant Commerce Clause ruling in that case. At least I can.
It would still fail.
But that's not this case. Trump's talking about.
I mean, the other problem is, I mean, just even for judges who like the Dormant Commerce Clause, it's not a shelter-in-place order doesn't discriminate against interstate commerce. It discriminates against all commerce, right? It doesn't preference or prefer local commerce over interstate commerce, right?
I think that's not fatal to the Dormant Commerce Clause, because as long as you're not under the discrimination prong.
I know. You still need the balancing. But Bobby, there are Supreme Court cases that suggest that public health tilts in favor of the state.
Oh yeah. No. And in fact, I like to go back to Gibbons v. Ogden itself, where in the,
right.
you know, where,
1824, where, that's an old chestnut.
That is an old chestnut. I love that case. I recall that is where you get the dicta for Johnson. Justice Johnson wants to talk about this idea and wants to rule on it. And it forces Marshall to say in passing, almost as if he's telling his colleague, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, there could be something like that. We'll see. And then later Wilson versus Blackbird Creek kind of reifies it a little bit more. But in Gibbons v. Ogden, there's such strong language from Marshall saying, like, of course, New York is still allowed to employ its quarantine laws or other public health laws because that's core state interest, that the interstate commerce concern doesn't override that. That goes all the way back. All right, I think we've kicked this one enough. What do you
think? It's too bad. I was almost up to – I'm looking at the Army military history document right now, and I'm up to the Pullman strike, and I'm just trying to find –
Okay, dig through there. I will tap dance a bit while we're going.
No, that's all right. It's fine.
Let me say something, because I actually have something I want to talk about while you're looking there.
Sure.
There's some really cool and interesting contact tracing stuff going on in pandemia right now. And so let's talk about that real briefly. Apple and Google made a splash by announcing that they were going to collaborate on adjusting both iOS and Android in ways that would make it much easier to develop a Singapore-style local storage of the data only contact tracing app, where if your phone's in Bluetooth range of the other person's phone for enough of a period of time, they'll exchange basically an anonymized but connectable moment of contact. And if later on, you know, so your phone's logging all these contacts you've had that trip that standard, then you go to the doctor, you've got COVID-19, the doctor certifies it and through some kind of process to be determined, then there's a way through this app that everyone who did have that contact with you, who's got that connection recorded, can get a notification with some sort of information, which could be calibrated as just notice. Maybe you should go get yourself tested. Sounds like Beverly Hills Cop, get the reference. Or it's a deep cut there. Or maybe even if it's tied in with something more draconian, it's a directive under local public health laws that you're now to self-quarantine. This has set off a lot of interesting commentary. I posted something on Lawfare about this the other day to put it in context with the larger story of what are the options for contact tracing, beginning with the traditional existing option of voluntary interviewing conducted by the nation's impressive but nonetheless finite in number public health field investigators who do these things, and kind of running the gamut from there to other possibilities, and noting that if we do go with something more heavy-handed and intrusive, especially if we have legislation that requires something like the contact tracing app, and above all, if it requires not just the contact tracing but location tracking, which it might, if we really think that that's the way out of it, you never know. There needs to be a sunset. There needs to be real-time public reporting, auditing by some inspector general or other such auditing type function. There needs to be automatic requirements that the code, it's wired into the code that the data deletes at a certain point, some specific number of days, and so forth. A lot of safeguards that would need to be legislated if we're going to do this in a way that's mandatory. And why would it be mandatory? Because if you don't get a lot of people doing this, and people debate about what the percentage of the population needs to be to make this effective, then it's not going to help enough. And I've heard people say 45%. I've heard people say 60. I've heard people say 80%. I don't know that there is any scenario in which 80% of our population carries their phones with them, phones enabled with this app that are on, powered, and are with people when they go out and about. So maybe we're never going to get there. But in any event, if we do try to go there, lots of safeguards needed. Steve, did you find Grover Cleveland's proclamation?
I think I did. Stand by. Okay, I don't have the literal text of the proclamation, but I have a reference to it that I'm going to put on the screen right now.
Cool.
So this is from the Army Center for Military History's history of the use of federal troops and domestic disorders. And Bobby, if you look at the left-hand page, this is page 144 of the 1877 to 1945 volume. You see this paragraph in the middle to Altgeld's arguments? So that Altgeld was the governor of Illinois. And so Cleveland tersely replied that he had ordered federal troops to Chicago in strict accordance with the Constitution and federal statutes, and had issued somewhat belatedly a cease and desist proclamation to the rioters. Right. So in other words, that there was a federalism fight because Cleveland was doing what the governor did not want him to do. And Cleveland was saying, I'm using these statutes and my constitutional authority to put down this strike.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and that was the governor of Illinois who did not want the military in there.
Correct. So I said, listen, we've spent an awful lot of time trying to make lemonade out of these lemons, right? I mean, I think the short version is you and I think even a creative reading of In re Debs doesn't get the president anywhere close to what he's doing. But I think it's important to stress that, like, this is why we care about these nuances, because, you know, you and I, neither of us are especially timid defenders of the idea that the executive branch has incredibly broad powers to respond to particular emergencies. But one of the things that keeps those powers in check is nuance, right? Is understanding that, like, those powers are finite, those powers have limits, and those powers are not just available whenever the president snaps his fingers. And so, you know, this is a textbook example of Trump doing exactly what I find most distressing about his presidency, which is saying, you know, I can do it, never mind the legal arguments, and his base saying, of course you can, because Obama.
L'état, c'est moi.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you, Louis Couture. We're going all over the cultural map tonight.
He also had a taste for shiny gold and flashy things.
I would never put President Trump in the same sentence as Louis XIV. We have a podcast episode where we've talked about Charles I, Louis XIV, and Alexander Hamilton. That's got to be a first.
I'm loving it.
So on Guantanamo, there was a ruling by the trial judge in the 9/11 case. I guess it was either last week or early this week. And in essence, Bobby, the ruling is that the defendants in the 9/11 case will not have access to the classified full version of the Senate Intelligence Committee's study into the CIA rendition detention interrogation program. Basically, that they have not sort of shown that they are entitled to that evidence as part of their defense in the 9/11 case. I have not yet seen a written opinion explaining and rationalizing this decision, so I don't want to weigh in on the merits yet, Bobby, because I think we should wait to see what the actual rationale is. Okay. I just want to say that I think this really dovetails with a point you and I have both made, although perhaps I stronger than you, that, you know, the best case scenario for the government is that these capital convictions are going to have to survive a post-conviction appeal to the DC Circuit. And, you know, I do think it is reasonable to wonder whether these kinds of rulings are actually going to make it harder, right, for these decisions, for these rulings to survive that appeal, if you're denying defendants access to potentially material, not exculpatory evidence, Bobby, nothing in the RDI report could possibly be exculpatory, but mitigation evidence in a capital case, right? That's where I could see, you know, civilian Article III judges being a little squeamish.
Do you think that if this case was going down in the Southern District, and the same, you know, discovery request is made, it's predictable how it would come out? Is it obvious that the request would have been granted?
I don't know that's obvious. I think there might have been a real fight over providing the defendants, or at least their counsel, with redacted summaries of that gets closer to what's in the classified report as opposed to the executive summary thereof. I don't know that for a fact, but I do think that it's at least a question. And there are going to be a lot of these questions sort of baked into the 9/11 trial as we get closer and closer to some inevitable, if, you know, forever in the future trial date.
By the way, I found it. I found the President's Proclamation. It's at the Miller Center's website's got it.
That's where I went wrong.
July 8th, 1894, Proclamation regarding the railroad strike. It's not written up as a legal document. It's the proclamation messaging to the strikers that they need to disperse. But I'll just
But Bobby, not because they were interfering, right? Not because they were violating the Dormant Commerce Clause, but because they were interfering with the mail.
I'll read. It's none of that. It's not about that at all. Now, granted, this isn't the basis for going into court.
Right.
But this was the basis for actually using the force that Justice Brewer talks about being the greater power within which the injunctive request was a lesser power. Whereas by reason, I've always wanted to, you know, be Grover Cleveland. So here I go. Whereas by reason of unlawful obstructions, combinations, and assemblages of person, it's become impracticable in the judgment of the President to enforce by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings the laws of the United States within the state of Illinois, especially in the city of Chicago within said state. And whereas for the purpose of enforcing the faithful execution of the laws of the United States and protecting its property and removing obstructions to the United States mails in the state and city aforesaid, the President has employed a part of the military forces of the United States. This at least wasn't framed as an interstate commerce thing.
No, it's you guys are violating federal statutes, and I need to enforce those federal statutes, and therefore I'm ordering you to disperse, I'm sending in the military, and I'm suing you.
This has been fun.
He is at Bobby Chesney. I am at Steve_Vladek. We are at NSL Podcast. You know, Bobby, Tuesday was the President has total power. Today he's, you know, adjourning Congress. What will tomorrow bring?
Powerful reopening.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. Stay safe out there, everybody.
Adios.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.